and welcome to Canucks Talk on Sportsnet 650. It's a truncated edition, and I am your co-host, flying solo, but not solo, you can't hear me, Thomas Drance. Before we get to Dave Nonis right off the hop, that of course is former Vancouver Canucks and Toronto Maple Leafs general manager Dave Nonis, I want to pay the bills, give a shout out to our loyal sponsors. Canucks Talk, of course, brought to you by Avenue Machinery and Douglas Lake Equipment, your Kubota all-star team. Visit avenuemachinery.ca, douglaslakeequipment.com for more. We're coming to you live, or I'm coming to you live specifically, just me and Dom on the producer's chair. From the Kintec studio, Kintec Footwear and Orthotics is Canada's favorite orthotics provider, supported by over 1,500 five-star Google reviews. Find your perfect fit at kintec.net. Oh, and it's 2,500 five-star Google reviews now. Excuse me. If you want to chime in, be a part of the discussion, 650-650, that's your Dunbar Lumber text line, the smart alternative. Visit Dunbar Lumber on Bridge Street in Ladner or Arbutus in Vancouver, or online at dumberlumber.com. All right, we're going to be joined shortly by Dave Nonis, and we will talk all things stretch run for the Vancouver Canucks. Dave, you're on the line now. How are you doing?
I'm doing great, thanks. How are you?
I'm doing well. So we always introduce you as the former general manager of the Vancouver Canucks and the Toronto Maple Leafs, but you're also a former Div 1 athlete. Are you into the madness? Do you fill out a bracket, Dave?
You know what? I don't fill out a bracket, and I actually don't follow it until it starts, which is, I think, today. And then now I'll start following it because I do find it very entertaining. Just the drama of it, the upsets. I think it's one of the most more emotional events in sports. So I'm not a huge college hoop follower, but once it gets to today, I do start watching it.
Understandably, more of a Frozen Four guy, I imagine, Dave.
Yeah, I'll watch more of the Frozen Four. I mean, it's a pretty big weekend in college hockey this weekend. You've got pretty much, actually, I think every single conference will crown a champion this weekend, and then I'll start doing the voting for the selection for the final 16 Division One. So it'll be a big weekend for college hockey as well.
Dave, one thing I love about March Madness, right, and that I wish I got more of from the NHL product is single game elimination, right? And we all know, you know, once you get to the playoffs and you get a game seven, when you get a single game elimination and you know, God bless you if you get single game elimination overtime, edge of your seat, best product in live sports entertainment. What do you recall of the stakes of elimination games? Are you on the same page as me, or based on your management tenure, is it something where, you know, you look forward to it, but it's tough to watch in the moment?
No, I'm on the same page as you. I mean, I think you have to have, at the pro level, you have to have a best of seven, in my opinion.
Yeah.
But if you can get that game seven, you know, there's nothing like that. There's nothing like that, I think, even in professional sports. I think hockey is the most interesting and exciting playoff because of it. So if you ever get to a game seven, that is something that feels, you know, special. I've been through a few of them. I mean, one was crushing, which was a 1994 loss to the Rangers.
Right.
And then one that I remember in Vancouver was the ultimately incredibly long game against Dallas.
Yes.
I mean, even though it was so long, you wanted it to end, but you almost didn't want it to end. I mean, it was a great feeling to be a part of that. So I'm with you. The one game elimination, if you can ever get to it, I think that is something special in sports.
What was that like when the game gets to, you know, it's, and I can't remember the exact number of minutes played, but I think it got up to the, you know, high hundreds, right? Maybe even hit two, because there were three overtime periods. Is that right? Before Henrik scored the winner. What's that like in the management suite as that game unfolds at exhausting length?
Well, you know what, it's funny. It's because the game slows down, and both teams, when you get to that point, they don't want to expend too much energy. You don't want to take any chances, so that again, the number of chances generated starts to drop dramatically as well. But it didn't lose its intensity. You're still on the edge of your seat. You still are looking for, you know, opportunities for your club. It is a harrowing thing to go through, Like I said, that's one thing. I remember that like it was yesterday. I remember going through the press box right after. It was just an amazing feeling to win that game. And probably because it did take so long, there was so much work involved in winning it.
Are you one of those people where you watch a game like, I know I am, you know, lots of people who watch hockey 82 times a year, or 41 times in person if you just cover home games, or 62 if you do a mix, have sort of a routine, right? Like, you eat at the same time because you know you need to, like, be able to go through the whole night, like, on and on. Does that change for you? Do you have a routine like that? And did that change for you on that particular evening?
Well, it didn't, because most of the routine is a build-up to the game. Mm. Yeah, I had a routine for sure. I mean, you come in at the same time, you buy a coffee from the
same place,
shop, you know, you park in the same spot. You know, we would generally try to have a pickup game right after the morning skates, so you'd get staff out there and do a quick pickup game and try to get some of the nervous energy out, and then you sit and wait. And the longest time for anybody involved with the team, I think players, coaches, management, is probably the hour to 2 hours before the game starts. It just seems to crawl along, particularly in the playoffs. And that's a tough time to sit and go through it. Yep. I was definitely a creature habit. Did almost the same thing every single day that we played on the road as well. You have a routine and you followed it.
Yeah, I never got to work a playoff game, but I remember hating a 7:30 start more than just about anything. Dave, the flip side of the coin of the playoffs is the stretch run for a team functionally eliminated. And we've seen this Canucks team play far better, far more disciplined, far more structured hockey under Rick Tocchet. And yet, we also saw this team get something of a dead cat bounce last season in low stakes games. And if you look at this team's record since Tocchet took over, they're winning games, but it's not too dissimilar from the bounces we've seen in Arizona and Anaheim. How much can you read into a team performing when the pressure is off, or at least the spectrum of pressure is reduced at this time of year? Do you have to be really careful?
I think there's a couple ways of looking at that. Yeah, teams often play it, let's, you know, use the word better, when the pressure is off, when there's nothing really at stake other than pride and putting a good effort in. And I think you do see teams that are just developing, that are, you know, maybe young, that seem to play a little bit better when they're eliminated. I mean, I think that's natural. You mentioned a couple. I mean, Anaheim, I think they're 5-2-3 of their last 10. Arizona is 5-3-2, and they have one of the best home records in the Western Conference. So you definitely do see that. The one thing I would say that I think is a little bit different in Vancouver from what I can see right now, and what I've seen since the change, is I think this winning streak, so to speak, the better play in particular, I don't think it's because of lack of pressure and now the guys are playing better. I think it's because there's more structure. I mean, the number of goals given up, in the last, I think during their 5-game winning streak, I think they're under 10. And that's not just good luck. I think that's them playing a much tighter brand of hockey, and I think that's what Rick Tocchet is known for. So I think that's a positive sign for the team. It doesn't mean that, that's the one thing I know that media and fans hate, and quite frankly, I don't like either, is when people take a 20-game snippet and extrapolate it into next year and say, well, we're going to have 112 points. It doesn't work. It doesn't work that way. Mm-hmm. But I think you can look at certain trends and how teams are playing, and if they are playing a more button-down style, a more cohesive style. And I think Vancouver's doing that. So I think that does bode well for them going into next year. Again, it doesn't mean that they're projected to make the playoffs, but I think that they're playing the way they have to play in order to have some success.
Can a run like this late in the season be the basis from which a more effective team culture can be constructed?
Oh, definitely. Yeah, it can do a couple things. You can set the table for next year in terms of team culture and how you want to play and expectations of the coaching staff. And it can also point out more holes, glaring holes that you have to fix. Like,
right.
One thing you can't do is if you've identified changes that you need to make and you're sure that those are changes that you have to make, you can't let a quality finish change that. If you think you have to make changes, winning 8 of your last 10, that really shouldn't shouldn't be the determining factor of whether or not you're going to go out in the summer and make some changes. You have either you have to or you don't. And a winning streak or a losing streak really shouldn't be the determining factor. So I think it's more about learning about how your team's going to play and learning about the quality of the character within the room. And I do think you can put some building blocks in terms of character and culture in the last 10, 15 games, particularly if you've changed coaching staffs, which they've done. And I think that's what the expectations are, I'm sure, with Rick Tocchet and staff right now, is to determine who's going to be part of this and who isn't.
Dave, I'm curious about a season from your management past in Vancouver, which is when the West Coast Express first arrived as a playoff team. And I don't remember the exact point totals, but the time they make the playoffs against the Detroit Red Wings, that first sort of arrival where this team is exciting again and the building is full again. And the next season, things start slow, like very slow. And it's not until after the Trevor Linden trade in, I don't remember if it was early December or January, but certainly, you know, well past American Thanksgiving, that the team got hot again. How do managers deal with the sort of fits and starts, the fact that team growth as a group maybe doesn't always proceed in a linear fashion?
Well, that time period was interesting, and you kind of bring up an interesting point. You can take a really big step forward and take two steps back if you're not careful, and mm-hmm. kind of that's where we felt we were headed. At that point, we felt good about the group. We knew we had some solid players and chemistry with the guys you mentioned. But we didn't have a whole lot of experience. We didn't have maybe a guy in there that could help us build that culture. And that's where Trevor really came in. Yes, we got him because he was still a very effective player at that point. But, you know, we both had Trevor and been around Trevor in the past, and we brought him back. Yeah, for his on-ice leadership, for his ability to play, but for his ability to help change the way the room worked. And he was very effective at it.
I want to ask you, too, about something that we saw last night. So last night, Connor Bedard has another 4 points. He's got 5 games left in his WHL career, almost certainly. I'd be shocked if he were there again next year. Now, with 60-plus goals in his 17-year-old season, this is the highest CHL, like the only other guy who's exceeded 60 goals in the CHL at the age of 17 since 2000 is Sidney Crosby, right? So we're starting to get to a place where the comps are outrageous. How do managers handle being toward the bottom of the standings when there's a prize like that on the board?
You know, I've been asked that quite a few times, and it's, you know, you wish you could manufacture a way to get to the spot where you had the best odds of winning, but you can't. Mm. You know, and we're seeing it now. Like, you're seeing Chicago, win big games that you didn't expect them to see. Like I said, Anaheim, I think they hadn't lost in regular, or only lost 2 games in the last 10 before last night in regulation. You know, do you think those teams want Bedard, that they would die for him? But you can't tell players not to play hard. Mm-hmm. And they're going to, yes, they would love to see them on their team as a teammate, but they're more interested in trying to finish well and play well. So it's really hard. I think that, teams talk about, or fans talk about, teams tanking, let's give ourselves the best chance. It really doesn't change much. I mean, I think at the end of the day, you're going to hope, if you're in the bottom, 2, 3, 4, that you are just lucky enough that the balls are going to roll your way and you're going to get this player, because obviously, there are players that are excellent players that were picked first overall. Jack Hughes is an excellent player. He's a star already, and he could end up being, a superstar. He's got that kind of talent. This player, although he hasn't done it yet, and you still have to do it before you're anointed, yep, he has the makings of something special. And I think that's where teams right now are just, they're going to mass daily and lighting candles. And that's what you try to get, all you can really do.
And presumably those candles get even more use from a management side as the draft lottery itself approaches. Do you have a particularly fond or not fond memory from a draft lottery you've attended in the past?
Well, again, I wasn't part of many of them, and but my last year in Toronto, you know, we made the determination. I think we've talked about this before, well before the trade deadline, that we just weren't going to be good enough with the group that we had. And at that point, we were still in a playoff position, but we just felt that we'd be stuck in that same playoff position. We'd be on the edge, maybe getting in, but not really having a chance to win. And we made that determination to try to sell off whatever we could, and we did. We traded our best defenseman at that time, one of our leading scorers, and we tried to put ourselves in a position where you're not trying to lose, because you can't, and you're going to win games down the stretch, but you're going to try to get the best pick you can get just by reducing the talent level on your team. You know, and that was a McDavid draft,
yeah.
And obviously, the team didn't get there, but they did end up with Mitch Marner. So you can't will it to happen, but you can do certain things to give yourself the best chance. And if you're looking to rebuild, that's really what you have to do. You have to look at giving yourself the best opportunity to restock the cupboard, and that's what the teams that are near the bottom right now are doing.
And Dave, how difficult a balance does a management team have to strike when you can see a path, right, based on late season form, based on the talent you have, to being good, but maybe you're not a contender all out. You want to take those steps forward, but you also got to be mindful of the future. How tricky can an off season where those sort of characteristics amalgamate, as it were, how tricky can that be on a manager to chart a path forward?
Well, I can. It also depends on the market. There are different pressures in different markets, and there's different ways of looking at what you need to do. But if your long-term goal is to actually win, then you have to be mindful of where you are as a club. So going out and spending every nickel that I have on July 1st just to try to get a little bit better, if my team isn't ready to take the next step, all that does is put you right in a quagmire. You're not going to be good enough. You've eaten up all your cap space. You can't take on good players during the year. All the things that teams that are trying to get better need to do. So that's the biggest thing, is honesty. Where is our team? And you have to have, look at it and say, we are not close enough yet. We should be looking at adding certain pieces in free agency if we can, and try to get some good players through via the trade route. But if your team really isn't good enough, spending every asset that you have to try to get 3% better, that actually stalls the process of making your team, into a championship club. So that's the biggest thing, is evaluating and being honest where you are, being honest with your owner, and having ownership understanding, and also being honest with the fan base, because, that's one of the biggest things, particularly in the Canadian market. I think that most Canadian markets will accept those types of discussions, as long as you have a path, like you said, a path forward, and you're telling them how you're going to do it. July 1st is often the day where most mistakes are made during the course of a year for teams that are trying to develop.
Dave, thanks so much for joining us today. We appreciate it. We'll chat with you next week, and enjoy the madness when you can catch it.
I will. Thanks. Take care of yourself.
Cheers. Thanks, Dave. Dave Nonis, former Canucks and Maple Leafs general manager, with some tremendous insight on everything from dealing with long games, management, day-to-day routines, and of course, balancing the future priorities, and the current. Good stuff from a Burnaby guy done well in his hockey career. All right, we're going to break now, and we'll come back. We'll answer some of your questions. We'll set up the game against Arizona. We'll keep talking Canucks on Canucks Talk on Sportsnet 650.
Catch up on what happened in Vancouver sports with Halford and Brough in the morning. Be sure to subscribe and download the show on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Hello and welcome back to Canucks Talk. Second segment, final segment of the day. It's a truncated version of Canucks Talk. I'm your host, Thomas Drance. Jamie Dodd on the morning show for the next 5 episodes. So tomorrow will be another truncated version of Canucks Talk. And then next week, we're going to have Harmon Dial fill in And then Jamie will be back on Friday. That's the plan for the show. Canucks Talk, of course, brought to you by Avenue Machinery and Douglas Lake Equipment, your Kubota all-star team. Visit avenuemachinery.ca, douglaslakeequipment.com for more. So, it's a Vancouver Canucks game day. The Canucks will be playing at Mullet Arena, a college barn, which is appropriate for March Madness. The Canucks themselves kicking off March Madness at the Arizona State facility that the Sun Devils share with the Arizona Coyotes. It's Vancouver's first trip to this building. And look, the Coyotes are winning at home. The atmosphere there looks pretty good, to be totally honest with you. At the end of the day, you'd rather probably, from a home ice advantage, from a raw home ice advantage perspective, play in a more intimate setting that's packed than in one of those cavernous 18,000-seat arenas that rarely gets filled in the lower bowl. And the Coyotes pose some difficulty for the Vancouver Canucks, but, man, as well as the Coyotes have played of late, and they have played pretty well, right? They have, for the most part, gone shot for shot with the Vancouver Canucks since the Canucks hired Rick Tocchet in late January. So as much as you want to say the Canucks have played really well, their best hockey over the last 7 weeks, you'd be correct. The Coyotes, almost the same record over the same time frame. Obviously, materially, this Coyotes team is worse, and like a lot worse than what the Vancouver Canucks are. By design, right? Like, this Coyotes team sold at the deadline. This Coyotes team would love to be, have 10 fewer points in the standings and be, you know, closer to having top odds for Connor McDavid. And yet, there are real threats on this team. One of them is a player worth watching closely today. His name's Matias Mikkeli, and he is a playmaking winger. There's like, you know, he's a rookie, and he's got about 40 points. I'm not saying he's a superstar or anything, so I want you to take this comp with a grain of salt, but think like poor man's Mitch Marner is what the sort of impact that Mikkeli can have. This team can be dangerous. Juuso Välimäki is playing good hockey. They've got some tough players up and down their lineup, and of course they've got Vejmelka, who we've yet to see be anywhere close to his best against the Vancouver Canucks. You know, we haven't seen a lot of goalies be at their best against the Vancouver Canucks with the way these shooters finish, but he always makes it interesting, right? Like, sometimes for the wrong reasons, but he's always fun to watch. For all that the Coyotes are punchless, toothless, more laundromat than hockey team, the Canucks are only favored minus 150 on the money line going into the game tonight. Now, does that in part reflect that the Coyotes have played some pretty good hockey at home? Sure. Does it reflect that the Coyotes themselves have been hot as well? Yeah. Does it reflect the gambling appetite of the public? Obviously. Vegas, at the end of the day, they have skin in the game. They want to get it right, but they're trying to incentivize people to bet on both sides so that they make money off their vig. All of that said, the Coyotes are one of Vegas's biggest fades of the NHL season. Like, an incredibly dramatic fade from Vegas. To this point, and I'm using all amalgamated data here, so this is all the Vegas sports books, but of course, I'd push you to playnow.com to place your wager so that the money stays in our community. And of course, if you gamble, use your game sense. Know your limit, play within it, all of that. With the Coyotes, they have been favored on the money line in just 8 games this season. 8! 8 games! Vegas only has expected the Coyotes to win in 8 games all season. And the Vancouver Canucks currently are minus 150 to faves to beat them. That's wild. There's only 11 or 12 games out of the 68 that the Coyotes have played all year in which they've been underdogs by this amount or less like the plus 125 that they are going into this evening's game. What does that tell you, right? What does that tell you? It's worth thinking about, right? Because we're in this moment where this team is hard to see clearly. I think that's fair to say, right? We're all sort of asking ourselves, what does this mean? What does this mean now that the Canucks have won 5 in a row, 8 of their last 11, look like they're playing better, have seen a bump in their underlying numbers, are killing penalties? Some of this team's biggest issues diffused over the course of the last 7 weeks. What does this mean? How do we see this clearly? And I always try and use objective data points as much as possible to try and pinpoint, to try and isolate, sort of to try and gut check my own biases on what exactly this team is. And to me, you know, it's not like the Coyotes are playing the second leg of a back-to-back. They're the home team, but for the Canucks to be only mild faves against Arizona going into tonight's game, that's a little bit of a fade on Vancouver's 5-game win streak, right? This team, with how well they're playing, if you want to subscribe to this notion that, like, under Rick Tocchet and since this new structure has been installed, the Vancouver Canucks are now a playoff-caliber team. They're not going to make the playoffs, but they're a playoff-caliber team now. Healthy Demko. Penalty kill going. Defense that's moving the puck better. Supporting off the rush better. Limiting the damage other teams are doing off the rush better. Then you have to ask yourself, why aren't the Canucks favored the way a playoff team would be against the Ducks? Why are they getting the kinds of odds that we'd expect the Ducks to have, you know, for a home game against St. Louis or Detroit? Right? This is not Vegas pricing the Canucks as if they buy, despite the 5-game win streak, despite the recent form. Vegas not pricing the Canucks like a team that's fixed by any means. And I think that's useful context. I think that's a useful thing to point out. I think it's a useful thing to grab hold of. When will Vegas be convinced, right? What does this team have to do to convince them? Because it's more. The bar's higher, according to the books, according to the people with the most incentive, the most skin in the game to get this right, right? They are looking at this Canucks team and they're saying, yeah, they should be favored against the Coyotes, but not by a lot. That is meaningful. That's a meaningful data point for a team we're still trying to figure out. What does this mean? What are they? With this game in particular, right? Canucks are going in to play this Coyotes team, and honestly, the Coyotes have done an awful lot of future-minded things from a hockey side, but the lack of budget behind it, right, makes this far from the sort of weaponize cap space and accumulate draft capital type rebuild that I often talk about and advocate for, right? Like, this is a rational hockey reaction from general manager Bill Armstrong, who I think's done a pretty good job, all things considered. It's a rational hockey reaction to an unreasonable business situation for the Coyotes and for the league. And I think it's really important to differentiate the two, right? The way that the Coyotes launder contracts, the way that they can't take any salary back at all to even, like, juice the return on Jacob Chychrun, that is not healthy for this league or this sport. But the problem solving of accumulating assets going forward and limiting your spend and figuring out smart ways to hit the cap floor without actually spending your owner's money, that stuff is actually pretty interesting. Like, Bill Armstrong at some point, you know, it would be curious to see what he could do with some competitive pressure, because he's taken some pretty interesting approaches to the massive problems that he inherited when he became Coyotes general manager. All that said, the Coyotes are absolutely with a bullet bottom six in the standings at league's end, right? Like, they're probably not getting into that Columbus mix, right? They're probably not getting into the Chicago-Anaheim mix, although if Anaheim keeps winning, maybe. San Jose, by the way, we haven't talked enough about San Jose's fantastic down the stretch tank job. They've nailed it. They are San Jose with a bullet is going to have extraordinary lottery odds. I bring all this up because I don't know if you saw Bedard's 4-point game last night. I'm imagining you didn't watch WHL hockey, but maybe you've seen some of the highlights on Twitter. Outrageous stuff. And we're now getting to a point where Bedard's company becomes like historic to a really eye-popping level. Okay, so over the weekend, he became the first 17-year-old CHL player since Sidney Crosby to score 60 goals. I mean, that's wild. Like, McDavid had 40. Stamkos didn't do it. You know, like, we're in, like, Tony Tanti, Eric Lindros territory, pretty much. Pavel Brendl territory, if you want me to bring up a less successful historical example. He's sitting at 63 goals, and so he's got a shot at 70. Right? He's only got 5 games left, but this is Connor Bedard we're talking about. It is not outrageous to think that he could score 2 hatties and then a goal in the other 3 and hit 70. Maybe, but probably not. At this point, probably a little late to challenge Pavel Brendl's WHL record for an age 17 season, but that's 73, by the way. But he could flirt with 70 here, which is just an outrageous haul, right? We are absolutely and without question talking about the best CHL season we've seen this millennium, since 2000. And probably dating back to, like, the early 90s, right? You probably have to get into, like, Pat LaFontaine and, you know, Chris Gratton, Eric Lindros territory to properly contextualize exactly what we're seeing from Bedard. The NHL draft lottery is now set May 8th, 4 p.m. Pacific time. And to me, that is the Stanley Cup for Canucks fans. The NHL is carrying it live. It's the most important date, right? This is it. And at the top of it is this Lynn Valley-born generational sniper, you know, who learned the game at the North Shore Winter Club shooting pucks at open ice as everyone around them was like, hey, how is this 120-pound 11-year-old shooting like he's a 6'2" pro at the University of New Hampshire? This is outrageous. The fact that it's Vancouver, Arizona, for me anyway, just sort of reminds me of those stakes, right? And reminds me too, like I mentioned the other day, feeling like I'm at a theme party and I showed up without wearing the theme costume. And I get this sense in this market right now, like, as this team wins games down the stretch and fans get excited about it, and I guarantee you the team itself is getting excited about it, next year is going to be fun. And I hope it is. I truly hope it is. This city deserves it. I just can't get over. I cannot constitutionally get over the fact that it's harmful. The fact that every point this team accumulates hurts their odds at getting this player. Like, and not just this player, but if you finish bottom 5, you can stay in the top 5 without necessarily needing to win the lottery. Right? Like, where the Canucks are at currently in the standings, by point percentage, they will be more likely to fall back and draft 10th than they will be to win one of the 2 drawings, and by a fair bit. Like, the real purpose of tanking isn't to get Bedard. That's the sexy, tangible reason that you do it. That's what you sell to ownership. The reason you do it is that if you don't win the lottery, which is always the most likely outcome, you don't fall back so far that you're not in on one of the elite players, right? That you're the team that gets to decide if you're willing to take on the risk with Matvei Michkov, who has had some red flags around him, obviously. But, you know, what's funny about red flags in the NHL draft is they seem to diminish when you go and score point per game in the KHL as a 17-year-old. Not hearing as much concerns from scouts since Michkov got loaned to Sochi and started going on a tear. you know, you get first dibs at a Benson. You get to decide, are we willing to take a slight winger given our team's build? I just can't get over it. I just can't get over that, as impressive as the way the club is playing, and as much as players don't want to lose, the fact that this organization didn't really try to get worse in the short term, took a win-now piece back for Bo Horvat and Anthony Beauvillier, right? Traded futures for a player who I don't think it's going to happen this month. I know there's uncertainty around Hronek. I don't think we're going to see him until much later this month, maybe early April. I still think we're weeks out from his return based on what I'm hearing. But they brought in a piece who at some point is going to come in and help them win games, like a top four defenseman, addressing their biggest need for even 2 weeks of the season. They've played Demko a ton, 6 of 7 going into tonight, and Demko set to play again, 7 of 7 start in 8 games against the Arizona Coyotes this evening. 7 and 8. I know we've joked about Andrei Kuzmenko being the anti-tank missile, but let's be real. Thatcher Demko is an entire armory of anti-tank weaponry. One man. We see it every game. Quinn Hughes playing 28. Pettersson playing 20+. Miller playing 20+. You know, you don't have to try to lose, but you don't have to treat every game down this meaningless stretch like it's game 7 either. You don't have to act like you're in a playoff race. And the worst part about this is that there is real organizational pressures that come to bear and truly motivate key figures internally, including ownership, based off of what they see down the stretch. Like, do you think the Miller extension gets done without the Boudreaux bump? Or do you think the team takes a different approach? Do you think the team spends in free agency without the Boudreaux bump? Or do you think the team takes a different approach? Right? There is excitement building internally now. The Canucks are cooking. And that leads you to a dangerous place too, given what this club has achieved, given their true talent level, which it's higher than where it's been, right? This is not a bottom five team. They lucked into an opportunity where they could have pulled the chute for a single season with a high-end core and an elite homegrown player at the absolute apex of the draft, and they opted not to. Far from opting to, in fact, they've decided instead to ride their best players hard, right? Improve their roster where possible at the deadline, Kratsov and on, and play their starter as if they're in a playoff race. Like, you cannot tell me that the rewards of winning games at this time of year are sufficient to not do the obvious thing at this time of year. Which, again, no one is suggesting that the players should try to lose. No one is suggesting that Rick Tocchet should try and lose either. 7 of 8 coming off of injury for Thatcher Demko? Does that make sense? The minutes burden being logged by Miller, Pettersson, Hughes, does that make sense to anybody? I can't pretend that I'm watching these wins and not thinking, this is folly. Raw folly. I can't. Like, I'm not. I like you guys too much. I trust you too much to lie to you. I just don't understand it. I'll never understand it. I'll never understand this organization's fascination with winning meaningless games late. In from the text inbox says, what part of we are not rebuilding do you not get? There's a difference, though, between not rebuilding and not chasing meaningless wins. Like, whether you're going to embark on a multi-year rebuild or not, given where this team was positioned in early January, and even more so in late January, why chase the dead cat bounce? This organization has chased the dead cat bounce. That's what makes no sense to me. Here's another text in from Ian. Look at Edmonton. They have McDavid. They are not contenders. Look at Toronto. They have Eminem. They're not even close to contending. Show me any Canadian team in the last 10 years who's been close. Look, the Edmonton Oilers made the conference final last year. They didn't win a game in the conference final, but the West is wide open. We have no idea if the Avs are going to get healthy or not. They have a shot this year. Not a great one. They've made a tremendous amount of mistakes, but they've got a shot. The Toronto Maple Leafs, they're fifth in the NHL in point percentage over the last 7 years. You're telling me you wouldn't take that? Their playoff failures, there's something wrong there. There's something wrong there. No question about it. Am I picking them to get by Tampa this year? Probably not. I didn't even like their deadline that much. But to say that a team that's top five in the NHL in terms of their regular season results over as large a sample as 5 years isn't close to contending, that's not true. That's not true. They lost in seven to the Tampa Bay Lightning a year ago. Like, they were right there. So, I don't know, man. I don't see it. I don't see it. Anyway, Canucks play in Arizona tonight. They'll see if they can keep this streak going. And as I size these teams up, there are two main takeaways I've got. One, Vegas, not sure what to make of the Rick Tocchet bump just yet. Not buying this Canucks team as a playoff caliber team. If they were, Vancouver would be minus 200 or something against a Coyotes team that has only been favored on the money line on 8 occasions in 67. How is that possible? Honestly, it is amazing that the Coyotes have only been favored on 8 occasions and are nowhere close to having the best odds for Connor Bedard. That is truly mind-blowing. Unreal stuff. And secondly, I like how the team is playing. I like the work that we've seen out of Rick Tocchet. I see reasons to believe in this bump. Oh, is that what we're doing? I forgot to do it. I'm not doing it alone. Okay, here we go. I see 10 minutes or 5 minutes of positivity because we're toward the end of the show. I had no intention of doing that. I figured our positivity was with Dave Nonis. I see reasons to believe that this is sustainable. Truly. I see what everyone else is talking about when they beat the word structure into the ground until it has no meaning. I actually believe this late run more than I did last year's. By a lot. Not even close. And yet, I will not and cannot pretend that chasing wins with this level of fervor late in a lost season is precisely the sort of thirsty desperation that has got the Canucks continually into this spot. Here's a text in, by the way. Imagine a situation where it's been 10 years since you ate. Bud, I can't even imagine a situation where it's been 10 minutes since I ate. Someone comes up to you and says, hey, free food for 15 years. And you say, nah, I'll stay hungry. Oh, that's the Canucks. That's the Canucks. Well summarized, my friend. And there you go. Here's my rant, my solo rant. We'll do it again tomorrow. We'll have a Coyotes game to recap. I promise I won't talk about the self-defeating thing. I needed to get it off my chest. And now I have a segment all to myself. Skip 10 minutes of positivity because it's not good for my health. And talk about two main things that I wanted to address. One, of course, Vegas still fading this team as a playoff caliber side. And two, why I just can't get on board with the excitement in this market right now, and certainly in the Canucks organization internally, about their results under Tocchet. It just makes no sense how important it seems to be to this club to win games at this time of year. That's going to do it. We'll be back tomorrow. Thank you for listening to Canucks Talk on Sportsnet 650.